Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Pat Schlarbaum, your reporter and host for today. Thank you for listening. Well, the weather today sounds appealing, partly sunny with a high near 29, although the wind chill values as low as zero, with winds out of the east-southeast at 6 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, a chance of snow, freezing drizzle and sleet, then freezing rain, likely after midnight. Saturday, there's additional chance of freezing rain late morning, then in rain in the afternoon with a high near 35. Saturday night rain, turning to rain and snow after 9 p.m. You get the picture. Wind gusting to 46 miles per hour with a chance of precipitation at 100%, with 2 to 4 inches of additional white stuff. Sunday, mostly sunny, yet blowing snow with a high near 22. A maybe snow on Monday's commute at 30% with a high of 13 degrees and a single-digit low of 3. And with that, let's welcome Dennis Hart's sunny disposition with his summary of this week's news.
Thanks very much. As I always say, and as I always mean, it's good to be here on this Friday. Let's start our news rundown with a look back to last Saturday when word came that Emily's Law had made it out of a subcommittee in the Iowa House. All three members of the House Transportation Subcommittee signed off on the bill. Emily's Law stipulates that anyone operating a motor vehicle who leaves the scene of an accident without knowing if that accident resulted in injury, serious injury, or the death of another person must notify law enforcement immediately after that person realizes that injury or death occurred. It's named after Emily Jacobs, an 18-year-old Iowa State University freshman who was struck and killed by a Cyride bus at Lincoln Way and Ash in Ames in 2015. Also last Saturday, a report that beer fans and local farmers gathered at Westtown Pub to meet the CEO of Miller Coors, who thanked farmers on behalf of his organization. Gavin Hattersley traveled through Iowa as part of a national Toast to Farmers tour. Some of those at the event said they thought Hattersley's visit was in response to controversy surrounding the use, or not, of specific ingredients in beer, including corn. The issue was sparked by a Bud Light commercial that aired during the Super Bowl earlier this month. That commercial featured a beer that is brewed without corn syrup. Miller Coors said that Bud Light failed to make a distinction between corn syrup and high fructose corn syrup, and said corn syrup is a normal part of the brewing process. Also last Saturday, a story about the company that created the biggest printed graphic in Ames. It's the sign that's on the back of the North End scoreboard at Jack Trice Stadium, the sign that indicates the name of the stadium and the Mid-American Energy Field inside. LRI Graphics of Grimes created it, and it's made of 222 panels of printed vinyl, more than 5,000 square feet of ink. One more note from last Saturday, word that a new hair salon had opened in Ames. It's called SJB Hair Studio, and it's at 827 Northwestern Avenue. Scott Ball owns it. On Sunday, word that Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames was awarded a $50,000 State Innovation Model Iowa grant. That money will go to help local agencies promote nutrition and food security. Also Sunday, a report on Centering Pregnancy in Ames, a program in which a group of women in the same pregnancy period get together with their providers and help each other throughout their pregnancy. At the beginning of each session, the women take their own vitals, check their weight and blood pressure, and record all the data in journals they received at the start of their first session. They also record the information on a separate sheet of paper so the clinic can check over all of it. The program started 2 years ago and has had 17 groups go through it so far. Sunday also brought word that Ames community members gathered to the public library to talk about the Reverend Martin Luther King's famous letter from a Birmingham jail. King wrote that letter to a group of white Southern clergymen while he was in jail in August 1963. In the letter, he wrote about justification of his nonviolent civil disobedience movements and called out the unjustness of segregation laws. Also Sunday, a word about retiring Ames Library Director Lynn Carey, who started at the library back in 1983. She's held a variety of roles at the library since then, before being appointed permanent director in 2012. During her time, she saw the library's role evolve from being a warehouse of books to becoming a community center. She also oversaw the renovation and grand reopening of the library in 2014. And, of course, Sunday brought word about Iowa State University's men's and women's basketball teams, both of which were in action on Saturday, and both of them won. The men's team defeated Kansas State 78-64. The women's team defeated Oklahoma State 89-67. Tuesday brought word that Central Iowa was bracing for another punch from Mother Nature, more snow. Ames had seen up to 35 inches of snow so far this winter, even before the midweek storm. The record for snowfall is tough to determine because Ames does not have an official snowfall reporting station like Des Moines does, so all Weather Service officials could say is, there's been a lot of snow around these parts this year. Also Tuesday, word that Iowa State University has never completed a final report on its flight service department after incidents in 2016 that spotlighted possible misuse and questionable practices at the hands of former ISU president Stephen Leith. Before Leith left the university in 2017, he repaid the school more than $36,000 for questionable trips he took with the university's plane and for damage he had caused to it. That plane was sold to a Cedar Rapids company, and Leith said the university would consider getting rid of its flight service department and staff, which was operating one other plane. Since then, the flight service operation was transferred from the Facilities, Planning, and Management Division to the Athletics Department, and most of the use of the remaining plane has been by Iowa State University coaches and athletic officials. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, word that an Iowa State University student had been arrested on charges that he restrained a woman in her dorm room and assaulted her. 19-year-old Corey Jackson Newell was charged with assault with intent to commit sexual abuse. Also Tuesday, a report on a former astronaut who spoke Monday night in Ames and who talked about his space mission that broke an American record. Captain Scott Kelly spoke at Stevens Auditorium. 4 years ago, he set the American record for the most consecutive days in space, 340 straight days on the International Space Station. Among other things, he talked about the physical changes his body experienced while he was in space. While he was on the space station, his identical twin brother Mark, who was on Earth, became part of a NASA study to see how space affects the human body. Tuesday also brought word from Huxley that the city council there defeated a motion to revisit past builder agreements that would have allowed builders to come back to the city to seek more reimbursement for infrastructure costs. The council also heard about two possible new developments and also tabled a request for funding to pay 560th Street for a new come-and-go store planned for the area near Interstate 35 and Iowa Highway 210. On Wednesday came word that the Story County Board of Supervisors delayed a decision about whether to provide funding for the proposed Healthy Life Center in Ames until at least March 12th. This after the announcement last month that fundraising efforts to support the project had fallen short. Two of the project's hoped-for contributors, Mary Greeley Medical Center and Heartland Senior Services, are scheduled to report on their possible contributions next week. When the project was first proposed, Story County and Heartland were asked to contribute $3.5 million each, while Mary Greeley was asked to contribute $7 million. Also Wednesday, a story about ongoing snow plowing and removal efforts in Ames and Story County. Story County engineer Darren Moon said that with all the snow the area has been having, workers have not had many days off in the past 3 weeks. He said the department is in charge of clearing about 950 miles of roads within the county, and that does not include roads inside city limits or state highways. The operations manager for the city of Ames, Justin Clausen, said the main problem the city has faced is that the nearly constant snow has caused so many plowing and removal challenges. Clausen said that in downtown Ames and in Campustown, there are not many places to store the snow that's being plowed, so it's piled up in certain areas to get it out of the way until dump trucks can take the snow elsewhere. Ames uses 11 snow plows and 2 pickup trucks with plows, along with plows taken from other departments or from contract partners. Both the city and county have enough salt and sand to last another few snowstorms. Meanwhile, Wednesday also brought word that the frequent snow ordinance declarations the city has made in recent weeks has resulted in more tickets being written to people who have not heeded those warnings. Police said about 50 tickets per recent storm have been issued. The main problem has been that people have been moving their cars back onto the street before the snow ordinance ends. Also Wednesday, word that the miniature donkey involved in a recent Boone County animal welfare case had been returned to its owners after they paid a bond for it to be released. The donkey had been found to be suffering from malnutrition and hypothermia. Its owners said the animal had escaped from an enclosure, been hit by a car, and ended up in a ditch. The owners received donations from the public, so they were able to pay the bond and get the animal back. One more note from Wednesday, word that Iowa State University's men's basketball team had played Baylor at the Hilton Coliseum in Ames on Tuesday night and lost to Baylor 73-69. Thursday, yesterday, brought word that the Story County Board of Supervisors voted in favor of reviewing the Master Matrix. and asking the governor and legislature to impose a moratorium on new or expanding animal feeding operations. The Matrix is a scoring system that gives county elected officials a chance to offer recommendations on confinement feeding operations that are applying for a construction permit. Meanwhile, yesterday, word that the Iowa Court of Appeals had rejected the appeal of a former high school band teacher who was convicted of having sex with one of his students. 31-year-old Kevin Jacob Muhlenthaler of Ames, who taught at North Polk High School, had been found guilty in 2017 and sentenced to 6 years in prison after a former student alleged that she and Muhlenthaler had had a sexual relationship. In his appeal, Muhlenthaler claimed his trial attorney had been ineffective. Also yesterday, word that Ames Chamber of Commerce board members heard about ways to improve the economic climate in Ames. Georgia Van Gundy, who is the executive director of the Iowa Business Council, spoke to board members on Wednesday. Her suggestions focused on helping people move up in their jobs and keeping more college-educated people from leaving the state. And one more note from yesterday, word that Iowa State's women's basketball team had defeated Oklahoma 91-70. And there you have it, your summary of the week's news in Ames from the pages of the Ames Tribune. I'm Dennis Hart, taking the weekend off now, but promising to return to this seat on Monday with a look at news from around Iowa. Between now and then, stay safe, stay warm, and have a great weekend.
Someday when the wind is still underneath that big blue sky, Mother Nature fill your soul, just let your spirit fly. We'll keep working towards a better world, and maybe our dreams will come true. Keep listening to this river, and you know that I'll run into you. Riverside Rendezvous. Whoa. Riverside Rendezvous.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI 89.1 FM, and I'm Pat Schlarbaum. So following the November elections of 2018, three applications were filed for CAFOs, the confinement animal feeding operations in Story County. One of the three was deemed unacceptably close to Nevada and a city park by the Story County Board of Supervisors. So on Tuesday, the Iowa Environmental Protection Commission ruled that the appeal that the Board of Supervisors had placed on one of those permits did not have the merit, and all three facilities received permits to proceed. But then on Tuesday evening, a public meeting governed by the Story County Board of Supervisors was held at Gates Auditorium in Nevada. So we asked Linda Merkin to fill us in on what happened concerning a moratorium ruling concerning future confinement animal feeding operations in Story County. With Linda Merkin, the Board of Supervisors, a new member, welcome to Local Talk.
Thank you very much.
And we've had a couple issues that have come to the forefront here in Story County. Primarily, there's been some applications for some CAFOs, some confinement animal feeding operations that were shared right after your election, I believe, in November.
Actually, the previous board voted on those applications. I had been elected, but I was not yet sworn in as a supervisor then.
I understand yesterday there was an appeal that the Story County Board of Supervisors had concerning a Longview application for a CAFO just north of Nevada, and the Environmental Protection Commission ruled that the appeal did not have substantive nature to rescind or take away that permit.
And I was not able to be there because we had another county meeting going on in Nevada. But I did talk to some people later who were there, and I think you were there. And I did also hear that the Environmental Protection Commission members had some very interesting questions, though. There was one vote in favor of the appeal, but even people who voted against the appeal seemed to have some interesting questions.
Yes, and there was one abstention from vote or recused from voting due to her family's operation. But last evening, we had the opportunity to gather as a community at the Gates Auditorium in Nevada. And this was a public meeting that had been canceled previously. So it was nice that about 100 people came.
I would say upwards to 100. I didn't get the final count, and I know we have it. But I was trying to do a count as the meeting went on, as well as listening to people. And it was a good crowd. And I was glad because we did have snow again. But it held off until about the end of the meeting, so we had to cancel it a couple times. I'm glad we were able to get to this issue because it's a very important one.
And what are the issues of a moratorium?
Well, first let me do just a brief summary of the law. I believe it was 2002 that the Iowa legislature passed the legislation that said that counties could not regulate CAFOs. Concentrated animal feeding operations, and that, or at least have very little to say about them. In 2003 is when they adopted this instrument called the Master Matrix. It has 880 points. An applicant for a CAFO needs to score 440 out of 880 points, and they can select which of the questions they want to answer. They don't have to answer deal with all of the aspects of the Master Matrix. Now, our county is one of, I believe, 88 or 89 counties that does score the Master Matrix for the DNR, even though all we can do is recommend to the DNR whether or not to approve an application. But we think it's important that we look at it so we know where the CAFOs are going to be, so we get our own look at it locally. That's all the authority we have locally right now, is that to review what somebody's wanting to do and to recommend to the DNR whether or not to approve it. Now, the DNR goes on the score, not on comments, not on if people are happy or not. They go on the score.
And a score of 50%.
A score of 50% is passing.
Is passing, and basically, you'll hear the term that our hands are tied. We have no regulatory authority or overview once the scoring mechanism of the Master Matrix has brought them enough points to have their facility approved.
The county's role is pretty limited, and some would say hands are tied, and that's pretty close. Yeah. What I have said for years is one thing that local officials can do and should do is they should advocate for change, even if they think that the law is not right or system is not right, is not taking into account the best interests of the residents of their county. County supervisors should advocate for change. So I said when I was running that one of my primary goals was going to be, if I were elected supervisor, to propose a resolution that we ask the governor and the legislature to open up the Master Matrix, look at everything, the Code of Iowa, the administrative rules, the Master Matrix itself, and to change that, bring it up to date, look at the flaws, correct those flaws, make it a stronger instrument. That's the resolution that I presented to the other supervisors for consideration. I also put in mind that we should have a moratorium on approving new CAFOs. That was a real sticking point for some people last evening. And I heard some folks who were producers saying that they didn't think that was right, you know, that would be why do that. My reasoning and the reasoning of some other people that I've heard is that it's going to take a while once our government, our state government, decides to do something about the Master Matrix. It could take a while for them to have a finished product. If they look at information, look at data, they look at research, and they do the job right, it's not going to be – and then there's also the political kind of strategizing, but it's not going to be done overnight. And if it's going to take years, if we're still using a very flawed system, we will get more and more CAFOs that are being built potentially in the wrong place, potentially not using the technology they should use to protect our water quality and our air quality. And a moratorium doesn't mean never again. A moratorium means let's take a pause. Let's take a pause. Let's get a better system. But in the meantime, let's not keep operating on a very flawed system.
And last evening, it seemed to be a pretty balanced of the presentations for and against the discussion of a moratorium. And it was brought out, as I recall, that 16 years is what we're living with. And in that time frame, there have been technological changes, things, everything changes. Were there other key points? What did you hear that really kind of bolstered your feelings that a moratorium is appropriate that would be adding Story County to 23 other counties? Was it a good gathering for you?
I thought it was a good gathering. One thing that disturbed me, though, was that some people assumed that somebody who wanted to change the master matrix and wanted to have a moratorium, some people thought that that made you anti-farm. And I didn't talk about it last night because everybody's trying to kind of establish their rural credentials, but I live on the farm that I grew up on. I live out in the country. I know a lot of people who have rural roots, who grew up on farms or who live on farms now, who don't think CAFOs, the way they are being regulated now or the lack of regulation, is the right thing for the future of our county. What I'm hoping we get out of it is some ability for everybody to sit down and look at information and look at data. I really think we need to have a basis in science on what we do when we do reopen and recreate the master matrix. I don't think it should be self-interest. I think it should be based on what are the facts, what is the research. Now, I heard data thrown around last night. I want to see more. I want to make sure we're looking at the right things. I want to make sure we're looking at the right studies. I want to make sure we do some study locally in our watersheds here to see what's happening to our water quality. We know we have impaired creeks and rivers in Story County. We know Iowa has really not good water quality. We need to hone in on that more and the sources and what we do about that. And CAFOs is a part of that. There's some other things that are also a part of that. And we got to look at the totality for water quality.
So in the big picture, there was a vote taken.
Yes.
2-3 with the Board of Supervisors that Story County would essentially be included with 23 other counties, requesting the legislature have a moratorium on construction of confinement animal feeding operations, and we can all move forward under some guidance of the 21st century that we're all hoping to improve our lifestyles here in Story County.
Exactly. Story County is developing in a lot of different ways. We have a lot of residential development. We have some business development. We have CAFOs coming in. We need to make sure that it all fits together and one type of development isn't precluding another type of development or making another type of development not possible. And I think that's all being good neighbors.
Yeah. And so thank you for your service. Is there anything else?
I think the last thing is I want to clarify again for people that because we passed a resolution calling for reopening the master matrix, improving it, and for a moratorium, that doesn't mean that the Story County supervisors have changed the lay of the land, so to speak, in Story County. We still have the system that's in the code and in the DNR. County supervisors still have very little. We have a role because we score the master matrix and make a recommendation, but this doesn't change and give us more authority. It doesn't change anything until the legislature acts, hopefully in concert with the governor. But it does put us on record with 23 other counties saying this needs to be changed. And I would encourage everybody who feels that way to be involved in talking to their legislators.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Linda Merkin, Board of Supervisors for the Story County in the heartland of Iowa. You're close to the pulse. Thank you.
journey had just begun.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your reporter and host, Pat Schlarbaum. This show is engineered by Aladdin Alcathery. And in recognition of African American History Month, I've also heard it referred to as Black History Month. This is Aladdin Alcathery, our engineer for Local Talk. Welcome.
Thanks, Pat. Yeah, it is Black History Month. I think the month is called Black History Month.
Yeah.
But my thoughts, I guess, during it's interesting because I'm, you know, it seems like a lot of us or a lot of the media is focused on the 2020 presidential election. So I had some thoughts about that in relation to Black History Month. And this presidential election, like most, I suppose, at least in the last 50 years or so, show or thoughts are how important the so-called black vote is to the Democratic Party. But simply put, to win a general election, Democrats need a strong, quote, black voter turnout. But this time, when Obama was president, that was kind of like a honeymoon period, you know, black president. He got elected. I think some of the reason he was elected was because of his race or color. But this time, issues affecting African Americans must be more centered than they were then. They weren't really centered. And the last presidential election, 2016, there were some issues, but they weren't really grasped by the Democrats. And I think that's probably why they didn't get the voter turnout and the Democrats lost. But this time you can hear a lot of it in the rhetoric. Every Democrat, and it's a whole bunch of them, are, you know, mentioning something to buy or to get a hold of that voting block. For instance, Elizabeth Warren, she mentions her impact, you know, she talks about the impact of race and racism on the economy. You got Julian Castro, who, you know, talks about the justice system. And I mean, it's a lot of them. Senator Gillibrand talks about institutional racism. Of course, you have Kamala Harris, who wants to associate her parents with the civil rights movement. You know, I mean, everybody. Cory Booker, justice reform. The list is long. Again, as I say, it goes on. My fear of that is people might fall for this again, just this rhetoric. But more interesting to me, let's talk about a little bit of black history, especially about the general election. So there have been a lot of African Americans who have run for president. Or not necessarily run for, but at least were nominated for. And there are a lot.
Throughout history.
Throughout history. And that's a whole show we mentioned. That could be a whole show to talk about that and why and what was behind a lot of that. Well, there is one article I read on NPR.com about a particular person, George Edwin Taylor, who ran for president in 1904. And, I mean, there's a story behind that. A little bit of background about that. So before the 13th Amendment, which freed slaves, there were these laws called the Fugitive Slave Laws, which basically said if a person held in service of labor, a slave or apprentice or indentured servant, runs away or flees to another state, the law said that they had to be returned to that owner in the state where that person ran away from. Mm-hmm. I mention that because this party that George Taylor ran under what's called the National Liberty Party, or the Liberty Party. And that party started, of course, long before him. Their platform was 1843. Their platform was to abolish slavery. So that's how that party started. But Mr. Taylor, the article is interesting. Again, it's on NPR, and we should probably post it to our website so folks can look at it. You know, a lot of folks remember Shirley Chisholm.
Sure.
In 1972, mm-hmm. who ran for president. In 1904, though, George Edwin Taylor, you know, he ran under called the National Negro Liberty Party, sometimes called the National Liberty Party. He was a journalist. He lived in Iowa, southern Iowa. At one point, he was in the Republican Party, 1892. And it's funny because African Americans were at one point primarily, as a voting bloc, part of the Republican Party. And then there was another time when they were Democratic Party. And so when Mr. Taylor ran, his thoughts were more that neither of these parties are doing anything for African Americans. So this party was under that platform. Now, he didn't get a whole lot of votes, got very few votes. But what was interesting, in 1904, 36 states sent representatives for the Liberty Party to their convention, 36 states. I'll read from the article. The party denounced the Democrats' disenfranchisement of black Americans. It questioned Theodore Roosevelt's fidelity to African Americans, and it stood for unqualified enforcement of the Constitution. That was the party's platform when he ran. They also wanted reparations for ex-slaves and independence for the Philippines. Interesting.
Yeah, very much.
The candidate was, you know, very interesting. He, one of a dozen children whose father was a slave, his mother was born free in the South. They were in Arkansas, I believe, when they were growing. And at the time, Arkansas had a law, if you were a freed slave, you needed to get out of the state or you're going to be a slave. So there were a lot of interesting things going on. That's really it. I'm touching on it, but I think maybe before this month is out, we can really do some serious talk about this
subject.
Well,
I'm always fascinated to learn about a Southern Iowa connection. There was a coal mining town referred to as Buxton, Iowa, uh-huh. and a very progressive community of miners. And the African-American influences were reveled in and celebrated. It's quite a community. I remember learning about it from Dorothy Schweder, an Iowa historian. And so let's talk about Buxton before the month is out.
You know, it's interesting because Iowa was one of the few states where a person of African descent could run for president. There were a lot of states where, mm-hmm. You know, it was only a few states where African-Americans had the right to vote. Mm-hmm. But Iowa was a little further. It was a lot of things. Yeah, again, we should talk about that. That would be a fantastic subject.
Wonderful. And what a segue to include the Ames Progressive Alliance here this morning. Is it Ann Kinzel?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Pat.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful morning. No snow.
In the forecast, however.
Well, let's not get too excited. I'll check the Fairway parking lot to see how busy it is, and that'll let me know what the real weather forecast is. Well, good morning, everybody. We're going to do things a little bit different today. I'm going to interview my co-host, Carolyn Myers, who's out of town, and we're fixing that up right now. And she's going to give us an update on the activities of the Ames Progressive Alliance. The Alliance has been busy lately, lots of things going on. She'll be happy to brief you on where things are going, where they've been. We'll do a little background for those of you who are not familiar with the Ames Progressive Alliance. And then Carolyn will interview me about how Ames's Healthy Life Center fits into a framework of modern public health activities. My background is in public health. And I think wellness is a wonderful community attribute. So this will be a little bit different today. But, you know, progressivism is about looking at difference as well. So I look forward to a fun and interesting 15-minute interlude this morning. Carolyn, are you with us?
I am.
Hey, well, good morning.
Good morning.
So we've started a little bit telling folks what we're going to do. So I think we'll just jump right in, if that's okay with you.
Of course.
Let's have you give us a little bit of a brief introduction to folks who maybe aren't in the know this morning about what the Ames Progressive Alliance is as an organization. Can you give us a brief history?
Oh, yes. Ames Progressive Alliance started, I think, back in like 2015, 2016, and it was more of an organization for, you know, because we wanted people to have more information about the government locally and how they can become involved. And we wanted people to, you know, have a reason to talk about issues and get involved with local elections. Because, you know, our local government is really where you can make the most impact on your day-to-day activities and how you can change things that affect you every day versus the nationwide politics environment. So, and, you know, we don't necessarily have, we have a hard time getting people to be more involved locally. So how can we get people more motivated to be involved locally?
Well, people do say that all politics is local, but you're right. Sometimes it is hard to get them to live that statement. What are some of the things that the Ames Progressive Alliance has done in the past to help people get more involved in the local side of politics?
Well, we've done some educational opportunities on how to, you know, maybe if you're considering running for local politics, how you can start that process, as well as, you know, we have a lot of local city boards and commissions, like the zoning city board, the human services city board, the library board of directors. So educating residents on how maybe applying to be on one of those boards or commissions is a good start for how you can become more involved in the local politics and government. So we try to send out information about that, as well as have candidate forums for local office. So we've in the past have done candidate forums for city council election, as well as the school board election, where we give opportunity to local nonprofits that have progressive ideals to ask questions of the candidates that pertain specifically to the goals of their group, as well as for the people who attend the forums to give them an opportunity to ask questions of the candidates and get them on record about where those candidates stand on particular issues.
You know, I've been part of that, and one of the things that I thought was really impressive about how the Ames Progressive Alliance handled those candidate forums was that you had childcare. I feel sometimes that people are kind of locked out of attending these things if they have young children, and it's kind of hard to bring young children to a candidate forum and ask them to participate. So, in a way, I can see how the Alliance has broadened people's ability to participate in local politics. Will you be continuing to do candidate forums?
Oh, yes. We plan to do two candidate forums this fall, one for the city council election and one for the school board election. We don't have official dates yet, but we do plan on doing that in October because the change that is happening this year election-wise is that instead of having a separate school board candidate election that was separate and earlier than the regular city election, both of those elections are happening on the same day and on the same ballot, so there won't be anything separate this year. But we will still continue to have separate forums, one for city council and one for school board forums, because those I feel like we need to give equal footing to both those positions because they're so important and essential to our community.
Absolutely. As a California transplant to Iowa, I was always amazed that Iowa didn't have consolidated elections. So It's great to hear that that's coming around. I think it has the opportunity to increase voter turnout, and I'm sure that's a important value for Ames Progressive Alliance.
Yes, definitely. There are definitely pros and cons to having it consolidated, but I think for sure it's going to bring more people out to the election because a lot of people, including myself, were kind of confused about why would we have a separate election for school board at a different time versus city the city elections. So, that's really going to be, I think that's going to really increase voter turnout, and I'm excited about that for this year.
So you said those will be held in the fall. I assume you'll still be having childcare?
Yes, we will be providing some, you know, adult supervised activities for kids, as we have in the past. because we find that it's very important for to make it easier for parents to be more involved. And it's just, you know, it can be really difficult for working families to be able to participate in such activities. So anything we can do to make that easier for them, we will.
And that'll be held at the Ames Public Library?
Yes, it will be held at the Ames Public Library. That is the plan at this point, yes.
Okay, so if people want to stay in touch with the Alliance and figure out what kind of events are coming up, like candidate forums or other activities you'll be participating in, how do people find out?
I would say the best way would be to go to our Facebook page. But we also have a website, and we're also on Twitter as well. You can also email us at amesprogressivealliance@gmail.com. If you have any questions or things that you want us to talk about that might be happening locally, or you have any ideas for us, please, you know, we love to have ideas and we love to hear from people.
Yes, I've seen your Facebook page, and I think it's a great addition to the community.
Yes. We try to not only post things that we are doing, but also other progressive type of events that would be happening that are that people might be interested in. And we encourage people to share anything that we share on our website. So if you see something that you're really interested in and you think that other people you know on Facebook might be interested in it as well, we encourage you to go ahead and share those activities.
Well, that's great. One of the things that's coming up in Ames, I think it's already started, is this 2040 planning exercise. I assume that the Ames Progressive Alliance is encouraging folks to participate in that important piece of work.
Definitely. We are very excited about the Ames 2040 Comprehensive Plan. One way that I'm kind of describing the Comprehensive Plan to people is imagine the city is being asked in a job interview, where do you see yourself in 2040? So the whole purpose of the plan is where do we want our city to be in the year 2040? What are some of the goals for the city in 2040? And this plan will give a guidance for all, you know, future growth, land use, business development, zoning, some of the street usage across the city, as well as maybe some sustainability issues that might be, that residents find important. Environmental sustainability is really important for a lot of people in our city, and we want to make sure that those goals are being listened to for this plan as well. We hope we will continue. We did send out emails and posted about the open houses that the city held earlier in February for the 2040 plan that was held at the library, so people could come and kind of learn where the city is right now. And in the future, when they have more events, we'll definitely be advertising about that and letting people know when it's happening and where they can go. And then one of the other goals we have is we want to do some additional type of education with people. We are working right now on getting someone to come and talk about zoning and what is the process of zoning and what does that really mean and how would somebody go about that. Because I think there's a lot of confusion or, the layperson doesn't necessarily understand how all those decisions are made in the city and how you go about zoning changes or what does the zoning of a particular piece of land really mean. So we want to make sure that people truly understand, because I think some of that is more kind of trapped in a black box that people don't really know about.
Sure. Well, that's great. Sounds like it's game on for progressives if they want to have some input into where the city's going. Participation is the key. Education is the key. And the Ames Progressive Alliance sounds like it's stepping up to the plate to get progressives involved. Well, Carolyn, that concludes the first segment of our little dual interview affair today. So I'm going to turn over the interviewer mantle to you and serve in your role now.
Definitely. Well, Anne, I know that you're very involved with public health, and I find that to be very awesome. And I'm just curious, you know, one of the things that's happening or what has been worked on in the past, and I know they're continuing to work on it, is the Healthy Life Center. And we did have an interview before with Nancy Carroll, who is the director of Heartland Senior Services, and she has been kind of the head person for this Healthy Life Center in Ames. And, you know, what have you heard from Nancy Carroll? Where are we right now as a city with the new Healthy Life Center? Where do you
Those are great questions, Carolyn. Yeah, I was lucky enough earlier in my career to be a member of the Iowa Department of Public Health, and I've also worked in healthcare as an attorney and in reform of healthcare. And I think that public or community health is a somewhat underutilized function in our 21st century. The kind of the little background in public health is that, you know, in the late 1800s, the biggest problem in America was clean water, mm-hmm. and clean food and clean air. And a lot of reform spurred by the public health movement addressed those things. We came together and spent collectively to improve our lives so that people could drink the water without being worried about cholera or diphtheria or other kinds of waterborne diseases. Then, starting in the 1900s and through most of the 20th century, we focused extensively on communicable diseases, and we spent our money collectively to prevent those. We developed vaccination. We developed antibiotics. Lots of public dollars and public health was involved in that. But the plagues of the 21st century are primarily related to people's obesity, the chronic diseases related to that, diabetes, other heart diseases, stroke, and some communicable diseases, but a lot of diseases that result from the way our lives have changed, how much we move, how much we don't move, and things like that. And I'm afraid that public health has not been as strong as an advocate for those things as it could have been. So that's kind of water under the bridge, and we have the opportunity in Ames to move forward, I think, with our Healthy Life Center, which can serve as a catalyst to reintroduce community wellness in Story County. This is not an Ames project. This is a Story County project, and it involves six major partners. I'm not going to go into the details here today. It's certainly discussed a lot in the paper, but it represents, I think, a tremendous opportunity to bring not only physical well-being into our community for the all-ages opportunities that this would present, but also addresses huge issues of loneliness. I just read a little article the other day that said that for people over 60, chronic loneliness was as bad as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Think about that for a minute. So I think our Healthy Life Center can help us address some of those issues. So the second part of your question is where we are now. Well, the six partners are looking at funding, and right now we are waiting on Story County to make its decision on the 12th of March. And if they participate fully, that will change some of the dynamic. If they choose to participate at less than the budgeted level, I think adjustments will have to be made. The local newspaper has done a great job of covering this. I encourage everybody to follow this interesting story for a unique opportunity for Story County. And I think that's it for us today. I want to thank my co-host, Carolyn, for hosting this show with me. And I want to thank KHOI also for giving us this opportunity to share with you what the Ames Progressive Alliance is doing to move our community towards a more progressive future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks, Pat.
Phenology is the chronicling of the dates of occurrences for plants and animals in our natural world. Nature's happenings like the first wallflower of the spring or the first butterfly are documented in a journal that includes those dates. Today's focus on phenology are the regal white-tailed bucks of Iowa. They will be shedding last year's set of antlers this time of winter. Finding shed deer antlers is a great thrill and offers special moments out of doors. The annual growth cycle for the white-tailed deer's antlers begins soon after the old rack has been shed. Antler buds for the new rack start growing from the pedicels, which are two permanent stumps of bone located on top of the buck's skull. A soft, hairy skin called velvet covers the antlers from the time they first appear as fuzzy knobs until they have reached full size. Growth is extremely fast, allowing the buck to produce his full rack in a few months. In late summer, the velvet begins shedding and gleaming tines are exposed. A buck's age, genetics, and diet are exhibited in his antlers. Also, where he has rubbed the velvet from his rack will stain the antlers different colors. Cedar, willows, basswood, or other trees will provide differing hues of color to the rack. The hormone testosterone keeps antlers firmly attached to the buck's head. However, when breeding season ends in late autumn, all that changes. Production of the hormone stops. Bone at the base of each antler erodes or wears away, and the rack is ready to be shed. People enjoying a midwinter walk may find one of these special gifts of the land. Areas where deer congregate or yard up during frigid weather are good areas to focus upon. Also, next to field margins, fence lines, or food plots are good places to look for shed deer antlers. Look under cedar groves where a low branch may entangle and dislodge an antler. It's been said that when antlers are shed, its match can sometimes be located within 150 yards. Searching in ever-increasing concentric circles from the spot of the first antler is a proven method of success. Native people used antlers for tools and pieces of antler for jewelry. They considered removal of an antler as a special gift and would return sacred tobacco to the spot in appreciation. Wherever deer antlers are shed, mammals like mice and squirrels are in search of antlers for the precious minerals they contain. For the modern conservationist that wants to give something back to the environment, a bit of mineral block can be placed where antlers are taken. And of course, if the shed antler goes undetected, its minerals will one day provide soil nutrients to grow the plants that a buck may eat to provide nourishment for his growing antlers. Such are the cycles of nature. Seeking elusive shed antlers of deer can bring hours of great exercise and can tell us much about the habits and genetics of white-tailed bucks. It is another form of deer hunting, and the big one is still out there for all to see, renewing a cycle of nature as a critical asset to Iowa's woodlands. And that's our Focus on Phenology. This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at www.oasco.org. And there is a Shed Deer Antler Hunt program sponsored by the Polk County Conservation Board Saturday, February 23rd from 1 until 2:30 p.m. at Thomas Mitchell Park in far southeast Polk County to our south. That address is 4590 Northeast 108th Street, Mitchellville, Iowa. Learn more about our incredible white-tailed deer herd by calling 515-323-5339. Reservations are not required for this event. And again, that's Saturday, February 23rd, 1 to 2:30 p.m. Call 515-323-5339 for the Shed White-tailed Deer Antler Hunt. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOY Community Radio, and I've been your reporter and host, Pat Schlarbaum. This show is engineered by Aladdin Alcatheri. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Earlier in the show, you heard our news summary report from Dennis Hart. We heard that Linda Merkins, Story County Board Supervisor member, about confinement animal feeding operations, and we heard from Ann Kinzel and Carolyn Myers with the Ames Progressive Alliance. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 5 p.m. on Fridays here on KHOI 89.1 FM. Also remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard Riverside Rendezvous by Big Blue Sky. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show. So if you would like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.